Welcome to another Salvation by Grace Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Hebrews. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, now the internet folk are with us. Turn to Hebrews 11. We're continuing through Hebrews 11. Let me review for just a moment why it is that we're taking the amount of time that we're taking to get through this chapter. I do plan to pick up the pace starting next week, and we will eventually, in our lifetimes, get through this chapter, I promise you. But the original author of this book, a Hebrew writing to Hebrews, says some very brief things, almost cryptic things, just single sentence references to particular people and particular events that hearken all the way back to the book of Genesis. He assumes that his Jewish readers know the details, so he's able to speak in shorthand. He's able to just make mention of these little things and then move on. And as I've said a couple of times, I think if the modern church suffers anywhere biblically, and the modern church suffers in many places biblically, but one of the biggest failings of the modern church is to teach the Old Testament. The Old Testament is, after all, the only scripture that was extant when the New Testament writers were writing. And so they all make reference back to what we call the Old Testament as the proof, as the evidence, as the substance of the theology that they're developing. They all use the Old Testament as their reference point. In fact, when Paul writes that the Word of God is theanostos, God breathed, he's talking about the Old Testament. We read that, and in our 21st century modern Gentile minds, we think, oh, Paul is saying that everything in the New Testament is God breathed. Well, I agree that it is, but it's not what Paul was saying. Paul was making the point that everything in the Old Testament, which was the only scripture he had at the moment, he said all of that is God-breathed. And so we really need to take the time to make sure that we understand the Old Testament references that the New Testament writers are using. And that's why we've been doing what we've been doing. But this morning, we're going to get to a real critical moment in the progression that the writer of Hebrews has been developing. And so we're going to take some time to really point out what's going on here, because so far, the particular people that he has taken the time to mention, once he got to Abraham, you know, he spoke of Enoch, he spoke of Noah, but once he got to Abraham, he started identifying Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the people who had the promised land promise. That was a tad redundant. They were the ones who had the land promise. They were the ones in particular who heard directly from God that this land belonged to them and to their descendants forever, in perpetuity. It's an ongoing, everlasting promise from God. This is your land. And so he mentions Abraham specifically. He mentions Isaac specifically. He mentions Jacob specifically. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they in particular had the land promise, even though they sojourned in that land in tents. They traveled like pilgrims. They had no permanent dwellings there. And in their own lifetimes, they never actually possessed that land. The land was always inhabited by foreigners. And so they were like sojourners, like travelers, like pilgrims, like Hebrews, in the land of promise. That's been his point so far. But they all embraced the promise, even though the promise wasn't theirs in their own lifetime. Because God is the one who made the promise, they all embraced the promise, saw it afar off, says the writer of Hebrews, and they looked forward to it coming to its fruition. And then he writes, and these all died, not having obtained the promise. And the next thing that happens as you work your way through Genesis, when you get to the end of the book of Genesis, the last telling of the land promise, the last handing down of the land promise, happens when Jacob is in Egypt. He has Joseph's sons brought before him, and he hands the land promise to Joseph's sons. But he also, in the same process, prophesies about all 12 of the boys and what's going to become of the tribes that are the descendants of those 12 boys. So really what the writer of Hebrews has done is that he has listed all the major players in the progress of the land promise. But by the end of the book of Genesis, something really dramatic happens. At the end of the book of Genesis, the Abrahamic covenant is divided into two portions. When the original Abrahamic covenant was formed between God and Abraham, there were two elements to the promise. One was a very spiritual element. He was told specifically that through his seed, all the families of the earth were going to be blessed. Well, that's a very spiritual promise. Paul, in the book of Galatians, identifies the seed as Christ. And so we have no problem saying that that spiritual promise was fulfilled in Christ. And through his death, burial, and resurrection, all families of the earth, not just Israelites, not just Judahites, all the families of the earth are blessed by the finished work of Christ and the introduction of the new covenant. So we can see a direct connection in the New Testament to that spiritual promise. But what we're going to read this morning, and I've referenced it several times over the weeks, kind of prepping you for this, but what we're going to see this morning is the place where that spiritual side of the Abrahamic covenant is separated from the right of the firstborn and the land promise, the physical end of the promise. The physical end of the promise is this land belongs to you and your descendants forever. But that promise ends up on the head of one of Joseph's sons, who, by the way, is half Egyptian going out the gate. And yet, that boy is going to end up with the promised inheritance, and that's what we're going to look at this morning. We're going to see it in the book of Genesis. We're going to see it again from 1 Chronicles 5. It's even in the Psalms. Israelites understood this, that the Abrahamic covenant, the land promise, belonged to Ephraim, and the spiritual promise of right and rulership belonged to Judah. It's spelled out in Genesis. That's what we're going to look at this morning. And I am convinced that it's why it's the next reference in the book of Hebrews. Because if you were a Hebrew, if you were a Jew, if you were an Israelite, you knew this. But talk to 21st century Gentiles and say, what's the deal with the Abrahamic covenant? And most of them will say, the what? Especially if you say to them, you know, the Abrahamic covenant is the foundation for the new covenant. The new covenant came about because God remembered the promises that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Most folks simply don't know that. But that's the Bible story. The Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional covenant that God made with Abraham, chose Abraham while he was in Ur of the Chaldees. He was not a believer. He was not seeking God. God chose him. It's a very early indication of God's sovereign choice and election. And then it is the first unconditional promise that you see in the Bible. You go to the New Covenant and you find other unconditional promises that include the promise of salvation to everyone who believes in the finished work of Christ. And so I say, if we're going to argue that God is going to keep the unconditional promise that he made to me, or to Jamie or to Wolf, or to Tom or to Elizabeth, the unconditional promise that he made to us is just as sure and secure as the unconditional promise that he made to Abraham. He's keeping every promise he ever made. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's why we've been stressing this, but I want you to see also that what the writer of Hebrews is doing is that he is chronologically listing each of the people who received the Abrahamic covenant, because the big topic is the land promise. And that even though they didn't get the land promise, they all embraced it by faith. The big overarching topic of Hebrews 11 is faith. And when he sat down, pen to papyri, and decided to find the ultimate example of faith that his readers could relate to, he decided the land promise was the place he would go. Because the land promise belongs historically to Israel, and even as he was writing, they had not yet fully occupied, taken over, received the land that God had promised them. So the writer of Hebrews sits down and writes that they believed in faith, they embraced the promise by faith, and so chapter 12 is going to start with, so seeing that we're encompassed about by this great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that does so easily beset us, and run our race with patience, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. So the big topic is faith, but the historic example of faith that he chose out of the whole of the Old Testament was the land promise. And I find that fascinating. You find it moderately interesting. I find it fascinating. Chapter 11, verse 21. By faith, Jacob, he's the one who has his name changed to Israel, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. And then in the next verse, he leaps into Exodus and talks about Moses. We'll get to that next week. And then we're going to pick up the pace pretty dramatically. But this morning, we're going to talk about those two verses. By faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on top of his staff. Turn back to the book of Genesis. We're going to start in Genesis 35. Go there. We are going to do a seven-league boots overview of the story of the 12 tribes of Israel and how it is that they end up in Egypt. We don't have time to go into a great deal of detail this morning. I hope you're at least passingly familiar with it, but I'm going to give you the big overview this morning. Starting in chapter 35, verse 22 ends with, "Now there were 12 sons of Jacob. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn." Remember that. Reuben is the firstborn. "Therefore, he ought to have the right of the firstborn. He ought to inherit everything that his father has." The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, then Simeon and Levi and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, were Dan and Naphtali. Verse 26, and the sons of Zilpah, who was Leah's maid, were Gad and Asher. And these are the sons of Jacob, who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Now quickly, the story is, Jacob loved a young girl. He fell in love first with Rachel. Rachel's father was upset that the younger girl was going to get married before the older girl, Leah. Rachel and Leah's father played a dirty trick on Jacob and said that Jacob had to work for him for 7 years in exchange for Rachel. So he worked his 7 years, and at the end of the 7 years, on his wedding night, he went into the tent. Dad said, "Don't worry, I'll send your wife into you." And instead of sending Rachel, sent Leah. And so that night, in the dark, in the tent, Jacob ended up with Leah. In the morning, he discovered that he had just married the older sister. And so he went back to Laban, his father-in-law, and made a new deal to work another 7 years for Rachel as well. 14 years he worked for Rachel. Rachel was his beloved. Rachel was the one, unfortunately, that was also barren. And so over time, he had children with Leah. He had children with Leah's handmaid. He had children with Rachel's handmaid. And then much later in life, God opened Rachel's womb, and Rachel had a boy named Joseph. Joseph then became the favorite boy of Dad. And because he was the favorite, you probably know the story, Dad gave him a cloak, a beautiful cloak that made all of his other brothers jealous. And so they hated their brother Joseph. Much later, Benjamin comes along. And that makes 12, ultimately, Benjamin being the youngest. So eventually the boys all decide to gang up on Joseph because dad clearly loves Joseph more than he loves the rest of us. And so they take him out, throw him into a pit. They're thinking about killing him when a traveling band of merchants go by and they sell him into slavery to the traveling merchants. And they go home, take the nice cloak, put animal blood on it, and go to Jacob and say, Joseph's dead. Here's his coat. It's all bloody. That's a shame. And of course, his father is distraught, as you could imagine. Time goes by. Joseph is sold into service into the house of a fellow named Potiphar. Potiphar has a wife. Potiphar's wife decides she likes the look of Joseph. She tries to entice Joseph into a little bit of a sexual tryst. He retains his integrity. He refuses her. She then charges him falsely, and as a result, he ends up in prison. Now, what you need to know about Joseph is that one of the reasons that the other boys, his brothers, learn to hate him is that Joseph would have dreams. And in these dreams, he always ended up at the top of the heap of all the brothers. He had a dream about sun and moon and stars and how they all did obeisance to his star. By the way, that imagery also shows up in the book of Revelation. Just thought I'd mention it. When you're interpreting the book of Revelation, remember that. He also had one about stacks of wheat and how all the other stacks of wheat bowed down to his stack of wheat. In other words, he kept having dreams that his brothers were going to someday bow down to him. So you can see why they would hate that. He's the youngest, he's dad's favorite, and he's walking around saying, I'm the one, you're all going to bow down in front of me. And so, of course, they just decided to get rid of him. So now he's in prison after Potiphar's wife charged him falsely. And while he's in prison, there's two guys there with him who have had dreams. He interprets their dreams. One of them, he interprets, you're going to end up being restored to your former job. You're going to work for the king again. You're going to be a taster for the king. That's all going to work out good for you. The other one, he says, you're going to die. That's bad news for you, but I'm right. And then, sure enough, time goes by. Things work out exactly according to the way those dreams went. And so, meanwhile, the one who got out, Joseph said, remember me. When you get out, remember me, okay? And he says, yeah, no problem. And then Joseph languishes in prison for many more years. Languishes. Languages? Is that what I said? He languages in prison. He speaks several languages. He's suddenly taken with the glossolalia. I'm just making stuff up now. He languishes in prison for several more years. And then Pharaoh has a dream. God got so lucky here. God providentially gives a bad dream to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh can't quite figure out the dream. And so Pharaoh says, I had this dream where there were seven cows that came up out of the Nile River. And they were big, healthy, fat cows came out of the river. And then I saw seven skinny, gaunt, sickly cows that came up out of the river. And the skinny, sickly cows ate the fat cows. What do you make of that? And all of his magicians and soothsayers said, oh, we're not real sure about that one. That's an odd dream you got going there, pal. I'm sorry, Pharaoh? They wouldn't call him pal. So they recall, I think it was the cupbearer recalls, that he says, you know, when I was in prison, there was a fellow down there who interpreted dreams between me and, I believe it was the baker. And between us, he said that I was going to be restored and he was going to die. And it turned out that way. There is an interpreter of dreams in your prison right now. And Pharaoh says, well, go get him. So they bring Joseph out of the prison, clean him up, bring him in front of Pharaoh. Pharaoh tells him the dream and Joseph says, here's the interpretation of your dream. He says, 7 years of plenty are coming to Egypt. That's what the fat cows are. But then there's going to be 7 years of famine. And during those 7 years of famine, everything that you collected during the plenty is going to be completely consumed. That's why the skinny cows ate the fat cows. That's what's coming your way, Pharaoh. Pharaoh's so impressed with that interpretation that he says, well, what should I do? And Joseph says, well, if I were you, I would start collecting now while there's plenty, and I would start collecting grain, and I would store it all up so that you're prepared for the famine that you now know is coming. Pharaoh says, well, you're the man then. Do it. Joseph then becomes second only to Pharaoh in power in Egypt, is given the authority to go around and do things like build barns and silos and bring in all the grain and starts collecting it. And then during the time of famine, as people are coming to get grain and wheat, they have to come to Pharaoh, to the household of the king, to get it. And little by little, they start bringing first their money so that they can eat. Then they start bringing their cattle so they can eat. They start bringing their land so they can eat. They start bringing everything they've got and start even putting themselves into servitude to Pharaoh over the course of 7 years, so that by the end of 7 years, Pharaoh is more powerful than when the whole thing began, and it's Joseph that did it for him. Pharaoh likes Joseph a lot. Then you read, rather providentially, that God brought that same famine up into Israel. And they find out that there's grain and food in Egypt. And so Jacob sends the boys. Run down there and get us some food in Egypt. And they go down and end up having to ask for food from their brother Joseph. Now Joseph, meanwhile, has gotten married. He's had a couple kids. And as you might imagine, he's now dressed in Egyptian dress, perhaps Egyptian makeup and headdress and everything else. So they stand in front of him and don't recognize who he is. But he knows them. So then he tests them to find out if they're honest men. So he says, is this really all of you? They say there's one more. There's one younger brother still, this Benjamin. And he says, well, bring him to me. And they say, well, we couldn't do that because our father has already lost one of his beloved sons. He would never let Benjamin go with us because that's his most beloved. Now, they return and they bring Benjamin. And so in the midst of all that, he discovers that they really are honest men. And he reveals himself to them. They then are even more afraid because they realize, oh, this is the brother that we threw into a pit. This cannot go well for us. And he, in an act of remarkable grace and mercy, forgives them and says to them, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good to bring about this present result that many people are saved alive. That's a verse that I often refer to when we talk about God's compatibilism. That they, in their sinfulness, in their depravity, they certainly meant it for evil. They weren't doing this in order that many people would be saved alive. They put their brother in the pit and lied to their father because they were doing evil things according to their own evil hearts. Joseph sees the big picture, sees that God did all that on purpose, and use their evil and their sin and their hatred of their brother in order to bring about the present result of him sitting on the throne of Egypt so that he could keep alive the 12 progenitors of Israel. So God made provision way in advance, knowing that he was going to bring about this famine. He gave a dream to Pharaoh so that Pharaoh would see the dream, bring Joseph up out of prison. Joseph would tell him about the famine. The famine would reach Israel, and God already made provision to keep the 12 tribes of Israel alive by putting their brother Joseph in that spot 14 years earlier via a pit. God had specifically put Joseph through all of that, through Potiphar, through prison, through dream interpretation, then through 7 years of plenty, and now into the famine. God did all that on purpose, said Joseph, so that the 12 tribes of Israel would be alive, the 12 progenitors. Anyway, Joseph then sets his brothers up in the land of Goshen, a land that is better than the surrounding area, and the book of Exodus begins, there rose up a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, and that's the beginning of a Pharaoh putting them into bondage. But for a period of time there, while Joseph was in control, he and his brothers had great sway and leadership there in Egypt. Now, in the midst of all that, the brothers go and get Dad and tell him, guess what? Turns out we were wrong. Joseph's not dead. Not only is he not dead, wait till you see his new job. And they bring him to Egypt. That's where we're going to pick up the story. Turn forward to chapter 48. I'm sure that I left out plenty of important details, but hopefully you got the big overview there. We're going to start in chapter 47, verse 27. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, as I mentioned, the good land, and they acquired property in it, and they were fruitful, and they became very numerous. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son, Joseph, and said to him, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your right hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt." That placing your hand under my thigh was a Middle Eastern way of forming a covenant. He's saying, make a covenant promise with me. Promise me this, don't bury me in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you will carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And Joseph said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. So we swore to him. Then Israel bowed and worshiped at the head of his bed. Why was it so important for Jacob to say, don't bury me here, bury me in Israel? Why was that so important to him? Because of the land promise. Because that's their land. He wanted to be buried there with his forefathers. He wanted to be in the land where Abraham and Isaac were. Because very early on, the Israelites also had understanding of the concept of resurrection. And he believed that when he resurrected, he wanted to be right there in that promised land. Even at the point of death, he was still counting on God's promises to all come to their fruition. And even if he didn't see it come to its fruition in this lifetime, he was expecting to see it come to its fruition in the future. And when he raised up out of the grave, he wanted to be standing there. It's amazing. But look at the faith. Look at the confidence in God's word. Chapter 48. Now it came about after these things that Joseph was told, behold, your father is sick. So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. And when it was told to Jacob, behold, your son Joseph has come to you, Israel collected his strength and he sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me in Luz in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me, and he said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of people, and I will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. What did he just recite? The Abrahamic covenant. And he said, God came to me and gave me the promise of the land covenant. So he's preparing to pass on the birthright blessing, which should by rights be going to Reuben because he's the firstborn. And instead, he's in a room with Joseph, the son that he prefers, and Joseph's two sons, who, as I mentioned, are half Egyptian to begin with. Now your two sons, says verse 5, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are mine. In other words, what he's saying is they're going to be counted, even though they're half Egyptian, they're going to be counted as my descendants. And history has shown us that that's exactly what happened. Ephraim becomes the primary tribe of the northern 10 tribes, so much so that one of the nicknames for the northern 10 tribes becomes Mount Ephraim. And oftentimes in the Old Testament, when the prophets speak of the northern and the southern tribes, they refer to them as Ephraim and Judah. So Ephraim, the youngest son of Joseph, ultimately is the dominant tribe among the northern 10. Why? Because of what we're about to read. Verse 6, but your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours, and they shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. The importance of the phrase, your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours, he's saying that the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh are going to belong to Joseph. They're going to be Israelites. They're half Israel, they're half Egyptian. And he's saying they're not going to be Egyptians. They're going to be Israelites. And as a consequence, of course, part of the land promise. But not just part of the land promise. Verse 7 says, "Now as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey. Then there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, 'Who are these?' And Joseph said to his father, 'They are my sons whom God has given me here.' So he said, 'Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see. And then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them, and he embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your children as well.'" Isn't that a sweet phrase? "I thought you were dead. I didn't expect to see you. And now God has graciously let me see you and your children." A remarkable thing. "Then Joseph took them from his knee and bowed with his face on the ground. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim at his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them close to him." He realizes that his father is about to bless the two boys. And so he does the standard thing. He takes his oldest boy, Manasseh, and puts him at his father's right hand. And since dad is blind, when dad puts his hands out, his right hand is going to fall on the head of the oldest boy. And whatever blessing it is that dad is going to pass on is going to be given to the oldest child, because that's what seems right and proper in Joseph's mind. So Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, and he brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand, and he laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and may my name live on in them, and the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." And as soon as he says that, "let them grow into a multitude," that's part of the Abrahamic covenant. And Joseph realizes at that moment that what dad's doing is he's passing down the birthright blessing and the Abrahamic covenant to the younger boy. So he interrupts dad in verse 17. "When Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him, and he grabbed his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head and put it on Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, 'Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head.' But his father refused and said, 'I know, my son, I know. He shall also become a people. He also shall be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations.' And he blessed them that day, saying, 'By you Israel shall pronounce blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and like Manasseh.'" A remarkable blessing. He's handing down a portion of the Abrahamic covenant to him. What did he leave out?
The spiritual part.
He left out the spiritual part. He did not say to Ephraim, "Through your descendants, all the children of the earth, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed." Didn't bring it up, didn't mention it. But he did say that he's going to become a multitude of nations, he's going to have a multitude of offspring. He gives him the right of the firstborn, to the degree that he even says that in all Israel they're going to say, "May you be like Ephraim," because Ephraim's going to be the primary tribe within Israel. And so for the first time you see this division of the Abrahamic covenant, where the spiritual aspect has been separated from the physical aspect, and the physical aspect has been handed to Ephraim, the youngest son of Joseph, the half-Egyptian boy. So here's what happens. Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your fathers." Why does he know that? Because God said it. This is the example of faith that the writer of Hebrews really wants to drive home. That even though they were all in Egypt, even though he set them up in Goshen, even though they stayed there for 17 years, all the stuff that we already know about them residing in Egypt, he says, nevertheless, when Jacob was on his deathbed, what does he say? He says, "Take my bones, bury me in Israel. God, the God of Abraham and Isaac, is going to take you back to the land of Canaan. The land promise is a firm promise. It's going to come true. It is your promise. Count on it. Believe God." That's what he's driving at. Now, of course, we know in the Abrahamic covenant, when Abraham asked God, "How do I know this is all true?" Because God said, "You're going to have a son, even though you have no children. You can have a son, he's going to become a multitude, like the stars of the heaven, like the sands of the seas. I'm going to give you this land, every place that your foot touches, as far as you can see. All of this land belongs to you and your descendants forever." And Abraham said, "How will I know?" And that's when God made the covenant, put him to sleep to make sure that Abraham would not try to pass through the animals. All Abraham could do was lay out the animals and divide them. And then God passed through the animals by himself, making a covenant all by himself. That's why I say it's an unconditional covenant. And as he passed through there and made the covenant promises, he told Abraham specifically, "You're going to die. You're going to be gathered to your people. And your descendants after you are going to be taken into a land where they're not known. And they're going to serve there for 400 years. So all the way back at Abraham, God already said that the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were going to end up in Egypt and were going to serve there for 400 years. But then he included, "And I'm going to bring them out greater than when they went in. And I'm going to bring them back to this land." And so even here, as you read the story of Joseph, recognize that God is doing everything he said he was going to do back there to Abraham. Yes, this land is yours. Yes, it belongs to your descendants. Yes, it belongs to them forever as an unconditional promise. But part of this promise includes, since you asked, "How will I know?" I'm going to tell you history in advance just so that you know this is going to happen, so that when your descendants have served for 400 years, and I bring them out with a mighty hand, and I bring them back to this land, they will know that everything I said to you is now coming true. This is their land. Go in and possess it. And as you know, they get right up to the edge of the land, and rather than confidently take the land, send in a couple of spies. The spies come back and say, "Oh, it's a great land, flowing with milk and honey. One problem, giants. There's giants in the land. And we saw ourselves as grasshoppers. We were so small compared to the size of the people of the land." And because of their failure to believe God, and they believed the spies instead, as a result, God had them wandering in the wilderness for 40 years until all the bones of the first generation were all strewn in the wilderness. It was the second generation, the second, that came out of Egypt that possessed the promised land. You see the pattern? God just keeps working in this pattern over and over and over again. So at this moment, Israel has given the promise to Ephraim, Joseph's youngest son, the firstborn promise, the physical promise. So what happened to the spiritual end of the Abrahamic covenant? Where did that go? Well, the answer to that is in chapter 49. So we're going to keep reading. The very end of chapter 48 says, "And I will give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with the sword and the bow." In other words, since you now have two sons, we're going to stretch the inheritance to include your two sons. Because as I said, there's now 13 tribes instead of 12. Then Jacob summoned all his sons. And he said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come." And starting in verse 2, he prophesies over each of his sons. Now, if you go back to our teaching through the book of Genesis on the website, we took a little bit of time to go through each of these. Reuben, importantly, he says in verse 3, "You're my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength. You're preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, but you're uncontrolled as water. so you will not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed and you defiled it, he went up to my couch. So apparently at some point, Reuben had a tryst with one of the women who belonged to his father. Really ugly story. As a result, he's now told, you don't get the right of inheritance. Now, even as he's saying this, we already know where the right of inheritance went. It went to Ephraim. Ephraim has it. We won't go through each of these, but go down to chapter 49, verse 8. At this moment, he turns his attention to Judah. And he says, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares to rouse him up? Okay, quick question. What tribe did Jesus come out of?
Judah.
Judah. What is one of the most common nicknames for Jesus?
The Lion
of the tribe of Judah. Isn't that interesting that he's back here saying Judah's going to be a lion's whelp and like a lion that rises up from the prey. In other words, one that's out there killing and conquering. And a lion, and because he's a lion, who dares to rouse him up? That's very similar to even what David would write later in saying, kiss the son, lest he be angry, and you perish from the way. This sense of reverence, he's a lion. Recognize who you're dealing with and treat him accordingly. Look at verse 10, the scepter. What is a scepter?
Ruling symbol.
A symbol of rulership. A scepter that a king would hold. A sign of authority. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. So Judah's going to get rulership. That's why all the brothers are going to bow down to Judah. The kings are going to come out of Judah. By the way, what tribe did David come out of?
Judah.
He then gets what we call the Davidic covenant. We've been looking at it on Wednesday nights. The Davidic covenant says that in David's family line, which is Judah, is going to come a king that is going to sit on David's throne and rule eternally. So through Judah, through that tribe, is the right of rulership. But then read what it says. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of all the peoples. Shiloh is a reference to Messiah. Until Messiah comes. So now Messiah is going to come through Judah. Okay, here comes the spiritual part of the Abrahamic covenant. Through the descendants of Abraham, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. Then that's handed down to Isaac. Through the descendants of Isaac, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. Then that's handed down to Jacob. Through a descendant of Jacob, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. But then at this point, Jacob says that it's going to be through Judah. And so now we know that it's through Judah specifically that Messiah is going to come, and the spiritual promise that all the families are going to be blessed is going to follow the path of Judah. Verse 11, in describing him, says, he ties his foal, which is a young donkey, to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. That's really interesting language, because riding on a donkey, riding on the foal of a donkey, is a sign of humility. And so he's showing that he's a ruler, he's a king, he has the scepter, but he's also humble. By the way, when Jesus rode into Jerusalem, what was he riding? He's riding on a donkey that had specifically what? Had a foal with her. And Jesus even takes the time to tell his apostles, now go into the city and you're going to find a man there and you're going to find a donkey. And there's going to be a donkey there tied with its foal. Bring that to me. If anyone says to you, what are you doing? You say the master has need of this. And in his triumphal entry, he rides in on a donkey and on the foal of a donkey, fulfilling this prophecy. How did Israel know these things? How did Jacob know these things at this moment? Well, the writer of Hebrews is going to say, well, he promised all these things and prophesied these things in faith. But then in contrast to being on a donkey's colt, he washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. Do you get the imagery? Oftentimes in the Bible, there is a one-for-one correlation between wine or the blood of grapes and blood. He picks up wine at the Last Supper and says, "This is my blood." And it says that he's going to come back wearing a vesture dipped in blood. If that language sounds familiar, that's exactly the way he's described in the book of Revelation. So Jacob describes the Messiah to come two ways. He comes once on a foal, humble, meek, and lowly. He comes another time with a vesture dipped in blood. He's coming back in vengeance. And he did one of those things in his first incarnation, and he's going to fulfill the other when he comes back. Now, this is really well known among the Israelites. Turn to 1 Chronicles. Turn to 1 Chronicles 5. We looked at it a couple weeks ago and just had Tom read it. I want you to see it now with your own eyes, now that we have read everything that we have read. Go past 1 and 2 Samuel, then you'll bump into a couple of Kings, and then you'll be at 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 is the beginning of the genealogies. Chronicles is, after all, a chronicle of the families of Israel. And so in chronicling the families and the genealogies of the various tribes of Israel, chapter 5 starts out with these words. These are vitally important words. And I cannot tell you how many times in my own ministerial life and in discussion about these things with people, with men, with pastors, I remember one time years ago sitting with David Morris after I had written about this very thing. And I sent the article to David to read before I put it out on the internet. And he read it, and we were together right after that at a conference. And he said to me, "You got it, Jim. This is the key to the whole thing. This is the key. If you don't get this, you get nothing else." And at that moment, he told me that I needed to write a book. And he said I needed to call the book Seedology. He was the first one to come up with that. And I said, "I don't have time for a book, but I've been teaching seedology ever since." What is the importance of the seed of Abraham and the progression of the genealogies all the way through the Old Testament? Well, the writer tells us this. The writer of 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1, "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed..." We already know that. We read it in Genesis. "Because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel." So Reuben's birthright, which should have gone to the firstborn, went to Ephraim. That means that the land promise, the promise of possession, all goes to Ephraim. It all belongs to that boy. But the writer of 1 Chronicles does not stop there. He then says, "So that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright," speaking of Reuben, "though," verse 2, "Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came the leader, yet the birthright belongs to Joseph." He's referring to exactly what we read back in Genesis. He's making it real clear as he spells out the genealogies. The birthright belongs to Ephraim, but rulership belongs to Judah. The birthright is no longer going to follow the genealogy. The birthright now belongs to Ephraim, Joseph's youngest son. But Judah gets the right of rulership, and through Judah comes the Messiah. And from that point forward, the promises that make up the Abrahamic covenant have been divided between a spiritual and a physical element. And the spiritual element is following Judah, and the physical element is following Ephraim. And that's why it's so important to understand that it cannot come to its full physical fruition. The promise of the land covenant cannot come to its final fruition and fulfillment. And any other F words that mean the same thing. It can't be accomplished until Ephraim specifically is back in that land. Right now, you go over there and you look around, you see Judahites over there, you see southern tribe folk over there. Sure, yeah. And yes, by the way, I have had some folks say to me, "But aren't there some northern tribe people mixed in among the southern tribe people?" Yes, there are. But the promise is, and Paul is very clear about the promise when he talks about it in Romans 11. And I think this is the only way to correctly understand Romans 11, is that Paul takes the time to say that after the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, then all Israel will be saved. Who's all Israel there? Well, he defines them this way. He says, as touching the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. So the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are someday going to be gathered, though they are enemies of the gospel today, right now, and they still are, even though they're still scattered today. All of the Old Testament prophets of Israel all say that all 12 tribes are going to be gathered again. That's the point of Ezekiel with his two sticks. On one of it, he writes for Judah, on the other for Ephraim. He takes the two sticks in his hand during the captivity of Israel in order to say that God is going to bring all of them collectively, all 12 tribes, back to the land that belongs to them. And at some point, they're going to get not just the land that is now, that little sliver of land that we call Israel, but they will one day have the complete geographical location that God promised to Abraham, and they've never had that. But they're going to. Now, the point of all of that I just said is, do you believe it?
Yes.
Okay, if you believe it, you believe it because it's what the Bible says. Now, we haven't seen it. It hasn't happened. Never has Israel, even when Joshua brought them into the land, never have they ever possessed all the land, all the way to the Euphrates River, that God has promised them. It simply never happened. So God has made promises that have yet to be actually, physically, genuinely, completely fulfilled. And yet, because God said it, I believe it. Because it's in God's word and God has a really good batting average going, I believe it. God is going to do what God is going to do because he said he's going to do it. And if you believe that, that's faith. You're exercising the same sort of faith that Abraham exercised when God first told it to him. And he believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. And so we today, we're looking at the promises of God and we're saying, well, we haven't seen those promises come to their fruition yet. And yet we believe them because God said it. That is faith, and God is going to credit that faith for righteousness so that when you stand before God, he is going to count you despite you. He's going to count you as righteous. The writer of Hebrews back there in chapter 10, 14 already said that by his one sacrifice, Christ perfected forever those that he sanctified. Why and how and what's the process? Well, the process is through faith, which is exchanged for righteousness. And so God is putting us in a situation where his word says one thing, but the circumstances of history say another thing. And we're going to stand on his word in faith and say, this is true because God said it, regardless of what the circumstances look like. And that, he says, is what Abraham did. It's what Isaac did. It's what Jacob did. It's what the boys did. And they all, though they hadn't received the promise, all died in faith, believing that God was going to accomplish every word of it. As we progress next week, we're going to get to Moses, and we're going to move much quicker than we did through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Ephraim. And we're going to see again that he's going to say, all these Old Testament characters all did these great works and these great exploits, and they all died not having received the promise, but they're still called the heroes of faith, because in the end, it's not about whether or not God fulfills the promise in my lifetime or in your lifetime. It's about the fact that God is going to keep every word he has ever promised anybody. And whether he does it now or whether he does it 1,000 years from now, he's faithful to his word. Our job is to believe it. Our job is to stand on it, to live by it, and if necessary, die in it. Die in faith. Wake up in righteousness. You don't get a better deal than that, because I know some of you. And yet, God's never going to bring up all the junk, all the stuff that worries us, all the stuff that scares us so bad, all the stuff that keeps us awake at night. Tom, turn to Psalm 60, verse 7. Jamie, look up Psalm 108, verse 8. In both of these psalms by David, he's going to make the same division that I've been talking about all morning. The only reason for pointing these out is to say this is common knowledge. It's common Old Testament knowledge. It's just not common contemporary church knowledge. But the writer of Hebrews knows that his audience knows it. There's a division between Ephraim and Judah. And he's going to use the same phrase in both of these. Psalm 60, verse 7 says,
Gilead is mine and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is my helmet and Judah is my scepter.
So Ephraim is my helmet, Judah is my scepter. See the division? Helmet, king, chief, prominent, but the rulership belongs to Judah. David understood that. Jamie, you've got Psalm 108, 8. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver.
So David knew it. The kings knew it. The Jews knew it. The Israelites knew it. Now we know it. It's going to help you when you read the New Testament to know that. And it's going to help you to understand things, like I said, like Romans 11. But it's going to help you to understand whenever you read someone like Paul, who is an Israelite, writing to a Jewish audience, as he does frequently in the book of Romans, as he does frequently in the Corinthian letters, it helps to know the same background that they already know. And that's what we've been trying to do for several weeks. I promise, starting next week, we'll move quicker, and we will get through chapter 11 at some point in my lifetime. Any questions about that? I know that was a great big chunk of information, but was it understandable?
Yes.
Was it comprehensible?
Yes.
All right, good. Yes, ma'am.
Do present-day Jews know what tribe they belong to?
Big picture stuff for just a moment. Jew is a shortened version of Judahite, and the southern kingdom became known as Judah. Mm-hmm. But in Judah, there were the Judahites, there were the Benjamites, and there were the Levites that served in the temple. And they collectively became known as Judah. Only descendants of Judah were ever called Jews. Now, some northern tribe folk did migrate because they were faithful to God. They did migrate into the southern kingdom to be near the temple, but they retained their tribal distinction. For instance, you read about Anna the prophetess, and you read that she was of the tribe of Asher. So even though she's there at the temple in the southern kingdom, she still has her tribal distinctions. She's still from Asher. Ever since the Assyrian captivity, the northern tribes have not reoccupied their land. So they've been scattered ever since. Now,
northern tribes don't call themselves Jews?
No. All 12 tribes are called Israelites, okay, because they're all descendants of Israel, Jacob. Every Jew is an Israelite. Not every Israelite is a Jew. Some are Manassites. Some are Asherites. Some are Danites. And they're called that all the way through the Old Testament. So they're identified by their tribal distinctions. Which is why it's so important, and why this is such a good question, that when you get to the book of Revelation, there are 144,000 marked in their forehead in some way. God marks them out. And it's 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and then they're named by name. So God knows where they are. God knows who they are. By the way, Jesus, during his earthly ministry, told his 12 apostles, he said, in the regeneration, you will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, then there have to be 12 tribes of Israel in the regeneration for them to actually judge, right? Revelation 21, New Jerusalem comes down out of heaven, built on the foundation of the 12 apostles, 12 gates bearing the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And they're named by name. So yes, those tribal distinctions not only remain throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament, but apparently out into eternity. Because they are, after all, the 12 tribes of Israel. So a Jew is an Israelite. Not all Israelites are Jews. And that fact, by the way, causes some confusion and consternation among folk because they will see Jews referred to as Israel, and they say, oh, well, see, now those names are getting intermixed. And they're not, if you pay attention. The Jewish writers in the Bible are very clear and very distinct. They will call a Jew an Israelite, but they will never call a Danite a Jew. They'll never call anybody from the northern 10 tribes a Jew. They'll call Jews Israelites. They'll call Danites Israelites. But they'll never call a Danite a Jew. It simply never happens.
So there are a lot of people descended, from Jacob. They don't know that they're...
Right. The question is, does God know? Yes. Did God write down particular names before the foundation of the world and write them in the Lamb's Book of Life? Yes. Did those people know they were in the Lamb's Book of Life before God enlightened them? No. So again, there's nothing different here. It's still God doing what God has always done. He has always chosen people and then at some point introduced himself to those people because those are the people he chose. And if he can do it for you or Dwight, why can't he do it for the tribe of Ephraim? He can, and he will, according to the Bible. But it's consistent with how God has always been and has always worked. Yeah? Good question. Long answer.
I got one scripture for you. All right. As a new heaven and a new earth which I make will remain before me, so shall your descendants and your name remain forever.
Your descendants and your name will remain forever. That's a promise from God. That has to happen. See how the Bible all just fits together? Any other questions? We're good? All right, say goodbye to the internet, folks.
Bye.
Where's Christian? We can't say goodbye to the internet, folks, without Christian. That means there's no saying goodbye.
See you next week.
Oh, good. Okay, good.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.